Hello and welcome to the Common Sense Politics Podcast. My name's Lars Swan, I'm the host, and our co-host is Linda Dubley.
Hi everyone, how you doing?
We have a special guest, Angela Knight, who was the former CEO of Energy UK and an economic secretary in the past, I believe.
That's right. Nice to be with you.
Excellent. So we're talking cost of living first, and then we'll move on to the energy.
Yeah, I'm really pleased you're here, Angela, because I'm sincerely hoping that you can demystify some of what has been going on. And actually, it's not just me. I think an awful lot of people in the country need to understand what's going on, because it's only through that understanding that they might be able to cope with a very, very challenging situation that we face. So I wanted to talk about the economy first. And we know that the economy has been badly hit by COVID and the Ukraine, but there are several other factors as well. Mm-hmm. I've heard recently some of the former governors of the Bank of England, deputy governors, say that actually we printed too much money in COVID. Just explain to me and to our listeners why that's so important.
Yes, it's fair enough. I mean, actually, we've got former governors arguing amongst themselves as well, which is unhelpful. And everybody seems to use words, and I think, what are they talking about? So, you know, it's never sort of explained. I will have a go. Stop me if I get complicated, all right?
Okay.
So what happened with COVID, and we locked down, and lots of other countries around the world locked down. And as we know, we stayed at home. Some of us could work from home, but others did jobs, and those jobs simply, you know, weren't done. We just weren't making things. We weren't putting things together. We weren't doing things for, well, in all, I suppose it was about a year, because we locked down, unlocked, and then we locked down. So what that meant is that, you know, our economy dropped, didn't it? Because all our economic activity, not making something, you're not doing something, you haven't, you know, got anything to sell.
It was extraordinary to look at the graphs at the time, because it kind of went along and then it just went
big trough.
A vertical line went down.
Absolutely.
It reminds me of the lemmings falling off the cliff.
No, it wasn't. Nice try, but no, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. Slap your wrist for that one. Except in one respect, it's quite a good idea. It's quite a good. I've slapped your wrist too early, because if the government hadn't said we are going to pay people, continue to pay people, then not only would the economy have dropped off the cliff, you know, that big drop down, but so would people. You know, they wouldn't been able to live because they got no income, and so that was what they call furlough scheme was all about. Effectively, you were paid to stay at home. Good idea. Absolutely good idea. You know, you got far worse. There are some countries that didn't do that. They're far worse mess than we were. So when we unlocked, you know, people were still able to keep the body and soul together, and they went back to work and then started to, you know, earn their own income, because, you know, the company or the business they're working for, it now reopened. And then, of course, we stopped again. And then we restarted. So why we've got a problem, and other countries have got a problem, is how do you get the money in order to pay people for not going to work?
You printed more.
Absolutely. You borrow it, in fact. You borrow the money. And so you borrow the money, but government does it by selling a type of bond. This is where I get complicated. Called a gilt. And it's just the phraseology we use. Other countries got exactly the same. So you're saying, right, you know, I'm going to sell you this. You give me this money. I guarantee that I'm going to pay you a percentage for X number of years, let's say 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, you'll get all your money back as well. So it's actually quite a good deal. Who wants to buy it? Things like pension funds and stuff like that. But the big but in all this, of course, is that the Bank of England's bought a lot. So the Bank of England's got, God knows how many, 800 billion or something, because they're kind of the end up as the buyer of last resort. So in some respects, it's sort of money going round and round. Mm. You know, it's going between the Bank of England and government, and some coming out and some going back and all that sort of thing. So we end up with a debt, and because people have been paid for staying at home, not going to work, is we also have put in some inflation in there. And then, of course, we're in a world where everybody's got the same problem.
Just explain to me how inflation comes in there.
Yeah, I will. So the way that inflation has worked is this, is that when this country opened up, much of the world more or less opened up, in a very similar period, you know, within the sort of same sort of 3 or 4 months, to greater or lesser degrees. But you know, at a high level, we all went from stop to go with a huge chunk of our economy. So all of a sudden, we're there back at work as people. We're earning some money. Again, that's good. So now we're able to buy stuff, which otherwise we hadn't been buying because you didn't quite know what's happened. But that stuff's not readily available because the manufacturing's only just started. So you've got things like sort of 100 people after 20 things. Well, the sellers of the 20 things, you know, put the price up. So that's one of the ways that inflation works. And if you just for a moment sort of swing it into energy and particularly into gas, during the lockdowns, businesses weren't operating anything like so much. They weren't using anything like the same quantity of electricity. A lot of electricity here and elsewhere is generated from gas. So therefore, the wells were closed down. There's lots of maintenance didn't take place. So, you know, we moved the world consumption down one hell of a lot. You know, it's really big drops and they're making huge losses, they being those who are the drillers and extractors for gas and electricity. Suddenly, everybody's switching the lights back on. There's just not enough to go round. And it takes time to reopen a well. And you might say to me, well, why did they shut in the first place? Nobody knew how long this was going on for. So it's that sort of stop-go has really caused a lot of different problems. And we're connected to the world. One of the most, dare I say it, absolutely ridiculous things that really got my goat during lockdown was this, is of course we're all testing ourselves, aren't we, our test kits. Where did our test kits come from? China. Where did this, you know, pandemic start? China. And you look at that and you say, why is it that we are even importing these test kits? Shouldn't we as a country say, right, we've got all these, what they call supply chains, you know, bringing stuff in from overseas. Isn't it about time that we pull some of that work back into the UK and focused on having more within our own economic boundaries? That doesn't mean I'm shutting doors to the world, but I am saying some of those long supply chains are really subject to what other governments do, and some of those governments are not particularly friendly.
And I'm sure Lars is desperate to chip in here.
Sorry.
But no. I just want to sort of hog another question. But so you've got all of that background, and then where energy is concerned, you've got the war in Ukraine. And that is restricting, obviously, desperately restricting the supply of gas. But also as a result of COVID, you've got the closure of the port of Shanghai, which is the biggest port in the world.
Correct.
And so nothing is coming out of the port of Shanghai anyway. So you've got very big, that's a very big complication in the supply chain, isn't it? And these are all big compounding factors.
Yes, because an aspect that has been a real Western European policy over, I'm going to say, the last 20, 30 years, somebody might say it's a bit longer, somebody might say it a bit less, is that we have increasingly focused our economies on that which we can do well and that which we can sell internationally at a higher price.
Which is understandable.
Which is understandable. And we have therefore closed or not grown or not expanded a lot of industry, because that which we produced here can be produced cheaper in other countries. And one of the reasons why some of the countries, particularly in the Far East, have grown as well as they have and have got a middle class and all that sort of thing is because we outsourced, whether clothes manufacturer is one obvious one, which we all know. Bank of England that time said, we've controlled inflation because we've put up interest rates. We controlled it. We didn't. We exported it. Because what we said is, we're no longer going to make a T-shirt in this country, say, and you're going to have to pay £12, £15 for it in the shops. Instead, we're going to buy the, going to shut down that manufacturing here. We're going to buy the T-shirts in from Bangladesh, where, and you can get them for now £5, £6, or £7 in the shop. Now, in one respect, that's a good, but if you take it too far,
risky,
then you opened yourself up to pretty high risk. And we've done that. And we've done that to too great a degree. And China, of course, therefore, doesn't just have us, but lots of other countries very dependent upon it because of all the manufacturing, it has, you know, it has had made a real policy of saying, we're going to do manufacturing for the world.
Yeah.
And it's done it. But we haven't focused on it.
I heard it was 29% of the world's manufacturing, 29% of the whole world.
Yeah. So, boy, can they call the tune, and they can call the tune for Western Europe. Did we all know the degree in which Germany was dependent on cheap gas from Russia? No. Who's called the tune on the energy supply for Europe? Answer, Russia. So we need to take the Russian example of how a country can spend over a number of years and by a number of actions, how it can get itself into a huge influential position. Mm. And part of that is to switch off and hold you to ransom, because that is exactly what Russia's done. We need to think about that in the context of some of the other things on which we are dependent as a country. I mean, I know you're keeping asking the energy question. I keep dodging it, but I'm not dodging it. Same one thing. Let me tell you another there. If we are going to have electric cars, if we are going to have all these sort of new distribution that we need of electricity, we need something called rare earths. For those of you who did chemistry at school, that's pieces of element in the middle of the periodic table. And we need a lot of lithium for the batteries. Where does it all come from?
Afghanistan, partly.
Well, and it comes from, and the refining is in China, and it comes from Russia, and it comes from the Stans. So are we really saying that we're going to take a lot of, in fact, compulsory actions here? You know, because it's drop dead day, isn't it? 2030 for buying a new car that is hydrocarbon, you know, there's petrol or diesel. So we say, on the one hand, it's drop dead at that point. But on the other hand, if we're on electric cars, we've if we're not careful, have already hitched our policy onto a third party country who doesn't look terribly favorably at the West. So there is much more thinking, strategic thinking, that in my view, governments have got to do. So shall I do the energy? Answer your energy question.
Go on.
Or shall I let Lars want to come in?
Lars is going to come
in. My only question is, do you think as a country, the UK kind of let go of its manufacturing? Because originally, back in sort of 40s, 50s and 60s, we were very good at manufacturing stuff. Because China's taken over because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Is now the time for us to start investing in manufacturing in the UK rather than outsourcing it to China?
Well, Lars, I come from the steel city. I'm born and bred in Sheffield. I didn't leave it till the end of the 90s. I'm bilingual in English and Yorkshire, you know. So presumably that's going to have offended some people listening to this podcast. And the answer is yes, I do. But of course, what I did is I lived through a period of time in Sheffield where the steelworks, which covered what we used to call the Lower Don Valley, because the River Don flows through Sheffield, and this whole acreage was absolutely covered with steel manufacturing, steel forging, steel casting, steel rolling, you know, the whole lot. And it went from that to a very, I suppose about only 15% of the land stayed in use for steel. But interestingly, what we didn't actually do is drop the production by the 85%. So if you say, I've only got 15% of my land and it was 100%, then has my production gone down by the same amount? And the answer is no. Because we were covering, or the industry was covering, lots of land because it was operating inefficiently. It employed a lot of people and hadn't really invested in the kit. And so over that period, which was more or less the 70s into the early 80s, it invested in the kit and it reduced the number of people. So we did do something. That doesn't mean that steel is now made particularly in this country, but we did do it at that time. We in the UK, like every country, has certain economic fears, and ours is unemployment. So look how much we look at the employment figures. And we have for years, decades, we've sort of judged how the country is doing by how many people are unemployed, are percentage unemployed. Germany's fear is inflation. So it does it on inflation. It judges itself on inflation. And other countries all have, you know, that key trigger. So something that we have done here in order to keep employment is we liberalised and liberalised our employment laws. which is good because if you can get rid of somebody, you'll hire them in the first place. If you can't fire them, you won't hire them. So we've liberalised and liberalised and made it very easy to employ people. So we've employed rather than invested. And to my mind, and I'm coming absolutely back to your point, Lars, that now we are in a circumstance in which we are full employment in effect.
Yeah. Mm.
So that means that you can't, as a business, say, well, no, instead of going and buying whatever it is, £1 million bit of new equipment, I'll employ another 20 people. You no longer got that trade-off. So that investment has got to take place. And the way to help it is for government to assist in proper, sensible, coordinated, targeted ways, which is one of the unsung things of the pandemic, because not only did they support that fantastic development of vaccines here in the country, but they also seed-corned the manufacturing facilities for vaccines as well. And we need to think about the future in that sort of context. What does it make sense for us to invest in this country? How do we broaden back our manufacturing base, not to the size of the 50s, but to a sensible balance? And how do we at least pull back some of our supply chains so we can't be held hostage because we can't get stuff because, you know, the country we normally get that stuff from has decided that it's going to do a twist on us in the same way that Russia's done on Europe.
Now, every commentator that I listened to this week said that it was good news that we had full employment. At least we didn't have to go back to the previous nightmare where we didn't have full employment.
Of course, if you remember years ago when they then changed the education rules of moving people from 16 to 18 in full-time employment.
Oh, yes,
that, of
yes,
course,
yes,
will have had a great way of manipulating your unemployment figures is by taking the 16 to 18-year-olds out of the employment system. So there's been a natural lowering of the employment figure. But from my understanding in the business world, from particularly in the catering industry and the hospitality industry, they struggle to get staff at all, let alone...
It's not just that.
It's very, very difficult.
You want to try and get them in IT. You want to try and get them in call centres. You know, Amazon was doing a sign-on deal for drivers and everybody's in the same pool. I'm not advocating that we go to high unemployment. Don't take me wrong. Mm. I'm advocating a better balance whereby to my mind, now is an obvious time to increase investment, which is about modernising, it's about building back some manufacturing here in this country. And, you know, there's an obvious pressure point because we haven't got enough people to do what we've been doing for years. Mm. So use that obvious pressure point and just swing that investment round a bit. After all, it takes quite a time to build back a manufacturing base.
Do we need more specialised immigrants?
Oh, I think we do. I think we've almost gone from saying our policy is open doors to our policy is closed doors. And I know that sort of sounds a bit extreme. Mm. And especially
when is what has happened.
But that is effective what's happened. And there's a few things in there where I think we should do some changes pretty quickly. I mean, for many years, there's been this large population, I'm going to call it, of sort of the 18 to 25s that's been mobile across Europe. You know, they've served you in Pret and Starbucks and they've been in the catering industry and all that sort of thing. Because young people love to go abroad, don't they?
Mm. Yeah.
To go and have a couple of years before or after university is absolutely fantastic. And that sort of 2-year pass for that sort of age group, I think, should come back into being for Europe. Mm. I mean, we do it for some countries outside Europe, don't we? I'm thinking Korea is one. I'm thinking Japan is another. But some people will know better than me. And having Brexited, the intention is to do that agreement with the EU, but we haven't done it. Well, why don't we just do it unilaterally? Why don't we say unilaterally, we will instigate that pass, apart from the fact it puts pressure on other countries to do the same. We have arrangements that we need to put in place with Europe. We need to get things moving a bit again. And there are a lot of skills that we need. The agricultural workers agreement, which says X number can come in to whatever it is, you know, pick the fruit, pick the flowers, whatever it is. I mean, that is a system that has worked quite well. But we need a bit more of it.
I think we'd love to get more of it. We'd love to go down that path. We might have to save that strand for another day. But the one thing I wanted to kind of get clear in my own head as well is this subject of inflation. And we heard Rishi Sunak in the hustings talking about that very eloquently. And he talks about pernicious inflation and what happens when inflation gets a grip. I'd really like to kind of explore that and open that up because I don't think most people understand. It's like a kind of boa constrictor that just pulls in.
It's quite a good name, pernicious inflation, because you've got inflation that happens but is going to go away, and then you've got inflation that you've gone and built in locally. So now I really am going to answer your energy question because that's one that's rolling through, and it'll start to drop out, quarter two, say, next year. So sort of as we get through the spring of next year, our big energy peak, which has really gone into inflation and really caused a big chunk of that 10-ish percent inflation, will move away. Now, the reason it'll move away is this. It may not seem like it in this country, but we're actually much better placed than most for gas and electricity. Much better. We're connected to the North Sea. So we've got, if you like, about half of all our gas is just on tap to us. It comes out of the North Sea.
I just want to ask very quickly, doesn't that have to go into a global market?
Not altogether. I'll come back to that. Not altogether is the answer, because you have long contracts. People don't. Yeah, if you're a gas power station, you don't say, right, okay, so I'm going to buy next week's supply tomorrow, do you? You're contracted. You buy a year, you can buy 18 months ahead. All our suppliers, our big suppliers, all have contracted for a lot of gas at a certain price for a long time ahead. That's why, for example, most of the big suppliers to us as domestics of consumers of gas and electricity have remained okay, and a whole load of the newcomers haven't. Mm-hmm. The newcomers have gone bust because they didn't buy ahead, or they didn't hedge, as they call it, you know, which says, oh, hedging your bets, you know, don't know what's going to happen. They just assumed they would always be able to buy on a wholesale market, you know, at a good price, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 3 months in advance.
That's a lesson for us all, actually.
Yeah, and the regulator shouldn't have allowed it, frankly. Mm. Should not have allowed it, but never mind, that's for another day. So much as we might complain about the big guys, thank goodness we've got them, because they know what survival looks like. And that's why sometimes what they sell to us is more expensive than what one of the new guys did, because they contracted ahead. So that's why I say, you know, today's price does not necessarily affect absolutely everything that we talk about. And we have longish contracts with Norway. So because the North Sea for the oil and gas, to say it's kind of split between the UK and Norway is dead simplistic. But there is a certain element, you know, that we've got a big chunk, Norway's got a big chunk, and some of the other countries have got bits and pieces as well that border the North Sea. And we have good relationships with Norway. There's a lot of mix and matching between, you know, companies and whatnot as the North Sea was developed. So we have a long contract with them. We have, you know, a chunk there. And we import between 10 and 15%. Now, that 10 or 15%, we have to buy in at whatever the world price is. And if you've got one of the world's largest sellers of gas, which is Russia, pulls it out mostly from the Arctic or close to the Arctic, got one of the largest sellers of gas says, oh, no, folks, I'm switching it off, then that really causes a disruption. And particularly into the EU. And Germany, of course, is one particularly affected, but so are many other countries. You know, don't ignore the problems of Italy or the problems of Spain. And an aspect of all this, which makes it very difficult, is Germany doesn't have any of those ports where it can take in the gas tankers of liquefied natural gas, which you can get, you know, from Qatar, from the US or wherever. And then they gasify it, you know, because it comes in liquid, gasify it, put it into the pipeline. Germany hadn't built any port, doesn't have any ports that do that. So this summer, we've been bringing it all into things like Milford Haven, putting it in our gas line, which is also connected to Europe because it works both ways, So that's one of the reasons why Europe has managed to fill up its gas storage. Of course, it has to have storage, because if you're not connected to the North Sea and you haven't got a port, you know, you've got to build your storage. So we've been actually doing, you know, the right thing of selling it up, but of gasifying it and sending it over to Europe and being paid for it. But we are affected, of course, by the world price of gas, not just for that 10 or 15%, but because long contracts don't all finish at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a business, you'll have a supply business, gas, electricity, you'll have a whole range of long contracts. So some of those all come up at the wrong time, the expensive time or whatever. So, of course, we're impacted, but it's not, and nobody should think, it's not as if, you know, all the gas is bought, you know, on the same day with the same price. The other aspect about gas and electricity, and by the way, I usually separate the two because by calling it energy, it actually confuses the picture, in my view. So the other thing about gas and electricity is how we produce electricity. We produce about 40% of it comes from our gas-fired power stations, and the balance, which is 60%, a chunk comes from our nuclear, though less as we close them down, but 12, 14%, and the rest comes from renewables. Renewables are great, but they don't work all the time. The wind doesn't blow all the time. And as we built our grid that distributes electricity up and down the country, we built it for our old power stations, which sat on our coal field, that comes straight down the middle. And then we put branches on the grid to pick up from the nuclear power stations, which we tucked out of the way right in the coast, you know, bind them on the coast where nobody could see them, and a lot of cold water for the cooling. Well, if you now say, well, we're going to build a lot of wind farms out to sea, and most of them come down the east side of the country, you have to move the grid as well. And so when you build a wind farm, not only do you have to build some more of the grid, which is expensive, but you've also got to have the backup there for when the wind doesn't blow. And the focus since, you know, our real sort of renewables policy came in beginning of the 2000s, the focus has all been on coal-fired stations are mucky, which they are. We need to close them down. Renewables are clean and green. We're going to put the subsidy to open those up. And there has been an absence of focus on what do we do about the transition. How do we make sure that as we close stuff down, we're opening stuff which also gives us continuous supply of electricity?
But why has there been that lack of focus? Because it's not something you can avoid. Yeah. So why was it not addressed sooner?
Yeah. This is where I'm going to be rude.
Go ahead.
First of all, the energy secretaries that we've had, you know, the cabinet ministers, like so much of Parliament, if they've got degrees, you know, where they've got degrees, lots of them have, they're in economics, they're in history, they're in PPE, they're in modern languages. Name me scientists and engineers. We've got lawyers aplenty.
Is that because scientists don't want to go into politics?
Well, hang on a minute. Then you unpick the civil service, and I would say it's even worse because you can't, you know, people end up in politics, A, because they like to, you know, they want to put their name forward, and B, then the electorate said, okay, we'll have you there. And then, you know, you're face fitted with whoever is the prime minister of the day. And it's the same with all parties. So it's not surprising that you can quite easily get a mismatch. But the civil service, there has never been attractive for scientists and engineers to join the civil service. And if ever there was a serious and hugely important bit of this country operation, it is your electricity supply, it's your gas supply, and that is a major engineering problem. And you haven't got them there. So that is one of the problems.
So Lars, who was the, I always forget his name, but he was the backbencher who was absolutely incandescent about what had gone on lately. And he said he had had enough, backbench MP, And he said he'd had enough of people with PPE degrees swanning around building their careers.
I haven't heard it, but they're right.
was it Gordon Walker, Charles Walker? Sir, I can't remember his name now. But
it could have been Charles Walker.
Yeah, I think it was Charles Walker. Yeah. I think that he made that exact point. And you know, even someone who is not political, who looks into the government, can see that it's like a talk fest.
Yes.
It's so, so confusing for people. Absolutely. Because what they want... they just want some guidance about what we do now, so, which brings me to a point here. We've all been told to brace ourselves for this winter because it's going to be really, really awful. You talk to someone like Martin Lewis, and Lars and I were chatting about this the other night. Martin Lewis thinks this winter is not the biggest problem. It's the winter following that's the biggest problem. I'm just interested in that. What do you think?
Don't know is the answer. I don't know why he's gone for that. This winter has started off well, if you see what I mean, because it started off warm.
The weather's so mild.
I know. For us who like skiing, you know, wondering...
no snow. Yeah.
So it started off warm. So when it does, the chances of it then getting really, really bad. So we have a bad one for, you know, gas and electricity supply. Well, we're already a month at that part that's called winter. So we've got 1 month where we haven't had a problem. So that gives you a little bit more flex for, you know, December, January, February, March. And so I do rather agree the point that it might not be as bad from the perspective of continuity of supply of gas and electricity of energy than might otherwise be the case. I'm not sure. I can't answer the question why he might set the next year.
I think he might set because some of the payments are ending in the spring. Some of the payments that people are owed.
Well, yeah. But that might not answer the question either. So I'm going back to electricity because, as I was saying, with electricity, we have this mixture of electricity generators, wind, solar, nuclear, gas. We've still got a couple of old coals there if we need it. And then there's then a whole variety of bits and pieces which go by the wonderful name of peaking power. Now, that's not peaking as in peaking duck, you know. It's as in when you hit a peak, what do? And the answer is they're diesel generators. And they have them as backup at hospitals and things like that. But there's also a few car parks, particularly in the southwest, absolutely bung full of these generators just in case we get very close. And, of course, you know, the southwest is not particularly well provided for. So how do you price it all? And the way we price it all is this, is think of it as sort of one big pool of electricity. Mm-hmm. And every generator is attached to that pool. So think of it like that as a picture. The demand is of the country is assessed by this offshoot of the national grid, which sits on top of the pool on a half-hour basis. So, of course, you need a lot of electricity in the mornings, not so much during the day, and then a lot of electricity in the evening. Every half hour, it says, this is what we need. And so it takes from the pool the generator's output that is needed to match that demand. And it's priced on the last generator required. Mm. So you can have, you know, some really cheap supply of electricity, let's call it an old nuclear power station. It gets the same price as if it was the most expensive generator that was required to meet the demand at the moment, gas. So the whole of the pool price is pulled up by the way we've got that calculation in place and by gas. Now, this calculation, this way of pricing electricity, partly it comes from the EU because we were part of the EU market, but it partly comes from providing a financial attractive way of getting more and more wind on the system, because wind was very expensive. So the intention was that, you know, the renewables got a high enough price all the time. And so it was skewed on the basis that the renewable would be the one that pulled up the price of the pool. Well, that might have been necessary at the start. Right now, it's barking mad. So if I pick up the graphs of gas prices, average gas prices around Europe, and it's a bit broader than that, and I pick up the electricity one, what you find is we're in with the pack on the price that we pay for gas. Electricity, we're right up, you know, we're high. So part of that's the pool price. And part of it is because all the additional subsidies that are out there for renewable electricity, and indeed some of the, you know, the social assistance we give on insulation and so forth, all sits on your electricity bill. Under 50% of your electricity bill is electricity. The rest is the add-ons. So our electricity price is high. There's two things we should do about that. The first is change the calculation on the pool. Now, it's easy to say. Mm. It's more complicated to do it. I won't go into the details, but I would certainly split it in two pools. You know, one I would call low carbon and the other I would call hydrocarbon pools. And you still get more of you get an average. So, you know, it's not pure, you get an average. But probably you bring down the wholesale price of electricity by about 20%.
But and that would make a huge difference.
And then the second is we've temporarily shifted some of the subsidies off the electricity bill. I think we need that off for permanent.
Okay.
So I look at this quite simply, and I look at Shell, and I look at BP, and I look at, you know, I appreciate the cost, the price that you sell it at is high, the wholesale price is high, but how does that equate to an extra, well, Shell in the last 3 months, an extra 9.5 billion
huge
profit.
Isn't it? Absolutely it's huge.
Because
that's their global profit. Don't forget, so it's not just
from us, but as a constituent or as a resident, I look at the paper and obviously I'm an accountant, so I kind of understand the difference between capital and revenue expenditure, and some of that profit might be reinvested
and so on. Yeah, fair enough.
But as somebody layman on the street, I see 9.5 billion pounds profit in 3 months, and think, well, why is the price so high? Why can't they reduce the price?
Yeah, that's because what most people think, Lars. You're not alone.
No, you're not alone. You're not alone. They're selling what they're taking out of the ground today at today's prices. And two years ago, they were making that sort of loss because nobody wanted the stuff, you know. Mm. So the oil and gas industry, you know, when it makes profit, it makes huge profits. And then, you know, when economic turndowns take place, it makes huge loss. Now, I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that is what happens. Yeah. Now, what we have historically done in the UK is that we have taxed more our oil and gas producers since Margaret Thatcher's day, forever, I think it was her.
Yeah, and there's a specialist department within HMRC just for oil and gas.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to get my dates right. I think it was then, but it might not be quite then. But for a very long time indeed, we have added an additional tax on the oil and gas industry in the North Sea. Sunak, when he was Chancellor, he added to that. So we now tax their profits, which we can get our arms around, because you can't get your global profits, get our arms around, at 65%. That's pretty good. What we've also done, though, is we said, but if you go and do a bit more drilling, you know, in our waters, then we'll offset that. So we've basically said, A, we're going to tax you more, but at the same time, we want you to drill more because we need gas, as is perfectly clear, available to us without having to bring tankers in from Qatar or whatever. You know, let's get a better handle on our own gas production for the time being. I'm not saying you have it forever, but, you know, it is a good interim fuel we need.
And are we doing that?
Which?
Getting a better handle.
I think so. But don't forget, these are decisions that have only been made, or increase the tax to 65% and offset a chunk as long as you invest. Those decisions are very recent. They're the last 3 to 4 months. The one good thing about what has happened to the price of gas and electricity is it's meant that there's been a much greater focus from the policy perspective on what we should be doing.
Long term.
Yeah. Short term, medium term, and long term. Mm. And we certainly need that, a lot of gas for the medium term, because we have to build more in the way of low carbon generation. Now, I've used the expression low carbon because I think that we have to do more about nuclear. I'm not a huge supporter of building massive one-off nuclear power stations that cost you sort of 10 or 15 billion and take 10 or 15 years to build. The reason I'm not a fan of that is because every one of them is a one-off. And we all know if you build a one-off, you know, you have issues every time. And secondly, you can only build something. You can't, you know, offer government balance sheet. You can't say to the private sector, OK, we need 10 or 15 billion. And then in sort of 10, 12 years time, you start getting your payback. It doesn't make sense.
And also, how politically palatable is that? Because although I've got sort of family members who say, actually, we should never have reduced our nuclear capability in terms of energy.
That's another story, actually.
But it's quite a difficult thing to sell to the electorate who may not get the intricacies of all of this, I think.
One way or another, any government, this one, next one, whatever, has got to lead properly and discuss and talk about energy and not be put off by, you know, 30-second sound bites, whatever's coming out of the Twitter feed and all the rest. You've got to take a deep breath and lead. And the sort of nuclear power stations that I would do, these small-scale ones developed by Rolls-Royce, you can build them in a couple of years and at a couple of billion. That means that the private sector, by which I mean, you know, these big investment funds, these big pension funds, they can say, do you know, that's a jolly good investment. I'll do that because you're starting to get your payback.
And that would increase manufacturing in this country, just the activity of it.
Absolutely. And you would put them on the sites of the existing power stations or the ones we've recently shut down. And you do that because that means you haven't got to build a whole lot more of the grid. I mean, the more we put wind out on the East Coast, the more we're going to have to cover, you know, some of the countryside down to the southeast with overhead cables. Well, how popular is that going to be in Norfolk and Suffolk and wherever? But if you pick up these small-scale nuclear, you can do probably one a year.
Sounds like an
for the next 10, 12 years.
Sounds like an interesting idea. Why is this not out in the arena being discussed?
You do find it in the technical parts of the newspapers. In the public domain, sometimes I feel I'm one of the few who's prepared to discuss it. But I do know that the applications are in two ways. First of all, to get the finality of the formal approvals, you know, from our various nuclear authorities of the design. But, of course, Rolls-Royce has been building nuclear for years, you know, the subs and all the rest of it. And the second, that they're seeking permissions to use some of the old sites. And these things, when I say small, what I mean is, you know, they're not vast like the big ones. But they do take up probably a couple of football pitches or something like that. But you've got then something that is containable, secure design, fantastic engineer. Rolls-Royce has always been a fantastic engineering company. As you rightly say, it's jobs and manufacturing back here in the UK, which is good. It provides a base load of electricity. So, you know, we can increase the percentage that comes out from reliable electricity. Mm. So you start to, you'll still need your gas because, of course, wind goes up and down, but you've got your base load there. It sorts out the problem that we've got at the moment for some of our old lady nuclear power stations, the most reliable in the world, but they, you know, they've lasted, they can be taken out. And you're low carbon, and you're not disturbing people, and you're not putting more cables up, you know.
And at the end of the day, if you are bringing people's energy bills down, you release money for food, which is the
important.
Other very, very important situation is
Isn't
food.
Just?
Because the food inflation, is food inflation higher than fuel inflation? I think it's slightly higher, isn't it? 12, 13%?
It's food high. Inflation? It's high. And food inflation.
Terrible.
Food inflation affects everybody. Well, gas and electricity does. But food inflation sometimes sort of gets a bit forgotten. And that's why you're absolutely right.
It's really worrying, actually. Yes. Very, very worrying. I mean, the reliance on food banks now.
Yeah.
Lars has been taking a look at actually.
As we slightly wrap up, because we're a bit over my time limit.
Sorry. But quite interesting. Not quite interesting. It's very interesting. Can I just ask a quick question? You would be a good energy secretary. Why aren't you in government?
I'm not in parliament. I lost my seat in 97. My children were small. They hadn't liked me, you know, saying bye-bye on Monday morning and hello on Thursday night. It'd be awful for small children. I didn't live in London. I lived, you know, my seat was in the East Midlands. I lived a few miles north of my seat. And then I've got to earn a living, didn't I, as well? So the whole thing, you look together and it doesn't work.
Yeah, we just need some people to understand what they're talking about.
So I've looked at some statistics on the Trussell Trust, who obviously run a number of food banks. Now, if you look at 2009-10, there were 40,896 people that had at least 3 days' worth of emergency food. That increased in 2013-14 to 900,000. And then in 2020-21, it was at 2.5 million.
Yeah.
But interestingly, in 21-22, it's dropped by just under 400,000.
That's interesting, because that's not the picture that's reflected by the media, is it?
No. So the graph, literally, it goes up from 2013-14, it jumps from 346 to almost a million. Mm. And then it gradually goes up and up and up until 2020-21, then it drops.
I've always been a journalist, and I suppose I am, you know, I'm definitely a member of the media, but I sometimes wonder that something makes a good headline, it makes a good story, you can cobble together a few sound bites, and there's a picture of people queuing at food banks. But those statistics tell a different picture, don't they?
Yes, I mean, I have a friend who works in a food bank, but they've changed the way they operate now. So instead of doing meals, they do food, which you can get. And you pay £5 a week if you're a single person, £10 if you're a family. And there's a whole lot of food which you can take any amount that you want of, and things like bread and vegetables and so forth. And then you can have a chicken and a pound of mince and a whole load of sausage and whatnot. So you can get your week's supply of food. It might be a bit boring, but you can get your week's supply of food for £10.
Mm, and you can make it interesting.
And if one thinks about it, it seems to me that, you know, we've got the food banks sitting where they do as almost a symbol of us not getting our social security right and not looking after the poor elements of society properly. I wonder why we don't consider enough food as an essential part. And so it automatically, you know, access to good quality food at a really subsidised price, why that shouldn't just be part of the package that you're entitled to if you get yourself into those sorts, or I shouldn't say get yourself, if you find
if
yourself
you,
in those sort of financial difficulties. So instead of it being sort of a referral, and somehow, you know, it can be sort of felt as absolutely not right, you know, society's not got it right, but it's a bit of shame. It shouldn't be, because you've got quality food there. So why not that sort of encompass that, as I say, as part of the entitlements that you get along with your rent and other things?
It's rationalising it, not emotionalising it.
Exactly, exactly. That's a very good way of putting it, and that's what I would like to see done. I still run it by the charities. I do think the Trussell Trust has done a very, very good job indeed, and there's others as well.
Mm.
But incorporate that as part of, and then you do know that at least the parents and the children have got that quality access to food, and so it ought to serve them better as families or as individuals when they find themselves in those difficulties.
So I think we kind of got to wrap up now, but strangely, I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic. Which is a plus.
I've tried to explain it. Yeah. I hope I have. I know I'm a bit long-winded.
No, but I think understanding stuff, does give you some visibility. When you've got some visibility, you know, you can, there's a famous phrase about, you know, getting your peace of mind helps you sleep at night. You need to understand situations before you can tackle them.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's just a fear. It's just terror. And I think that's affecting a lot of people.
I think so.
Terrorised by what's happening, frankly.
To my mind, give people a plan. Even if it looks tricky, they can see what's happening. Give them nothing, and all we do is live in fear. I entirely agree with you.
Brilliant. That was very fascinating, Angela, and thank you very much for coming along. We will, of course, be back next week with another edition of Common Sense Politics.
And another interesting guest.
Yes.
Mm.